From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop, and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, October 3rd through Friday, October 7th, 2022. It was a week of war and threats, mudslinging politics, a stock market roller coaster, gas prices back on the rise, a great federal pot pardon, post-Ian finger-pointing, Musk and Twitter on again, the Trump six-ring legal circus, and Tom and Giselle heading for divorce court. Get ready for a powerful hour of Black Belt Talk Radio, during which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. We've got lefties, we've got righties, and we've got fence sitters. Please don't get angry. Just listen closely. And while doing so, maintain a degree of educated skepticism, regardless of whether or not you agree. Here at the Michael Harrison Wrap, we're equal opportunity offenders united against the idiots who threaten to destroy our democracy. We'll be joined by Kevin Casey at Talkers with a countdown of the 10 biggest topics of the week. Martha Zoller in Georgia on the Herschel Walker abortion scandal. Jack Heath in New Hampshire on dirty, filthy politics. Dr. Murray Sabrin in Fort Myers, Florida on a hurricane's aftermath. Matthew B. Harrison in Springfield, Mass. On the Biden pot party. Glenn Beck in Texas on Donald Trump and the GOP. And Tavis Smiley in Los Angeles on political differences among African Americans. Influential yappers from across the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do a daily dance of affirmation. In a fragmented, noisy world where we try to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, heard coast to coast and around the world on great radio stations across the U.S. and the U.K. The past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information is gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. This installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap is brought to you in part by the rock group Gun Hill Road and their provocative music video titled Idiots. Check it out at idiotsvideo.com. Crazy, 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 crazy. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, the executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, please give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about topics on talk shows across America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10 this week, celebrities in the news. There was a big buzz that went beyond the sports world about football star Tom Brady and his supermodel wife Giselle Bundchen each hiring divorce lawyers.
Other celebrities in the news include Alec Baldwin, who settled with the victim's family on the Rust shooting case, and Kim Kardashian, who was fined $1.6 million by the SEC for allegedly endorsing an unregistered cryptocurrency.
At number 9, big tech tied with the Musk Twitter deal. The on-again, off-again Elon Musk Twitter deal is on again.
In other big tech news, the House passed an antitrust package this week that would give federal enforcers more resources to crack down on anti-competitive behavior.
At number 8, a four-way tie between race relations, abortion, LGBTQ rights, and the Biden pot pardon. The president's pardon of thousands of people convicted of federal marijuana possession violations was a major step this week toward cannabis decriminalization.
On the abortion front, Herschel Walker's Senate campaign in Georgia suffered a setback over allegations that the pro-life candidate once funded a woman's abortion. But will it make a difference in the outcome of the polarized election is anyone's guess.
At number 7, COVID-19 and other health-related issues. There seems to be a disconnect between how much Americans actually care about COVID-19 anymore and the true status of the threat posed by the pandemic.
A rise in European stats on the virus have health officials worried that yet another wave of the disease may strike America this winter.
At number 6, Donald Trump's legal woes. All the issues are still in play. The Mar-a-Lago papers, the DOJ probe, the January 6th committee investigation, the New York Attorney General fraud lawsuit, the Georgia election tampering case, the rape character defamation case, and much more.
You need a legal degree and a scorecard to keep up with all the ongoing complex developments in the life of Teflon Don, the most investigated high-profile individual in modern history.
At number 5, the aftermath of Hurricane Ian and climate change. And now comes the political finger-pointing.
Ironically, President Biden and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis seem to be on the same page on this issue.
At number four, a tie between immigration and crime. Biden and DeSantis are certainly not on the same page on these issues.
And the Democrats face the anger and frustration by even their own constituents on these two growing problems going into the midterms. And it's not just guns. A suspect is in custody after two people were killed and six others were wounded in a series of stabbings in front of a casino in Las Vegas on Thursday.
At number three, politics and the midterm elections. Close races for Congress, the Senate, and a number of governorships are coming down to the wire in a polarized nation getting ready for the midterms just weeks away.
The Senate races in Pennsylvania and Georgia are in the national spotlight, as well as the interesting gubernatorial race in Arizona, in which a Trump-supported election denier is given a good statistical chance at being elected.
At number two, the economy. Stock market continues to be a herky-jerky ride, and gas prices are beginning to rise again.
Meanwhile, the OPEC Plus alliance of oil exporting countries decided to sharply cut production to support sagging oil prices, a move that could further raise the cost of gasoline in America, a huge setback for the Biden administration.
And at number one this week, the Russia-Ukraine war and foreign affairs, including anti-government unrest in Iran. The war grinds on, and Putin's desperate threats of tactical nuclear escalation amidst battlefield setbacks and growing opposition at home have the world on edge.
Meantime, the Nobel Peace Prize has just been awarded to human rights advocate Alice Baliatsky from Belarus, the Russian Human Rights Organization Memorial, and the Ukrainian Human Rights Organization Center for Civil Liberties. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Politics and media are two of the mainstays in the national conversation. The Democrats and Republicans are battling it out on a state-by-state level to gain or maintain control of both houses of Congress in the November midterms. And as always the case, the state of Georgia is an ongoing hotspot in terms of races with national implications. Let's touch base with our go-to correspondent in the Peach State, one of the most politically astute radio talk show hosts in America, Martha Zoller of WDUN Gainesville.
The Daily Beast put a report out a couple of days ago saying that there was a woman that wanted to remain anonymous, that Herschel Walker had paid for an abortion. She said the abortion was $525 and she had a receipt. She had a check from him for $700 and he has denied this vehemently. This is supposedly from 2009. There's been some drip, drip, drip out of more to the story, saying that this woman is actually one of the mothers of one of his illegitimate children that were discovered earlier in the campaign. So it's been kind of interesting. I think all of us were expecting this. What you got to look at is the timestamp, because in 2009 is when he wrote his book. He did the big interview sitting with his ex-wife, talked about the fact he had been diagnosed with multiple personality disorder. I think they may call it something different now, and that he had gotten treatment and he was doing better, and that, you know, he was a changed man. And so it's important that this timeline is that all these events that are being dripped out right now are from 2009 or earlier. So they come in that time that he's already talked about. But I will tell you, it's caused a lot of issues in Georgia. You've got a lot of Republicans. My radio show is in the most Republican area in Georgia. About 60% of Republican voters live in my listening area. And they're not saying they're not going to vote for Herschel Walker, but they're saying they have pause about it and they're thinking about it. I think ultimately what will happen, Michael, is that people that say they might skip a race, meaning they go in and they vote for everybody else and not in the Senate race because they just morally can't vote for Herschel Walker. Mm-hmm. That's a possibility. I think that's not as likely as people saying it. When you get into that ballot box, it's really hard to skip a race if you're voting for everything else. But I do think that Herschel Walker needs to get the discussion back onto the issues and away from, you know, his own personal life, which was a mess before 2009 by his own admission.
He's not very good at talking about the issues, though. That's one of the problems, I would imagine, for Republicans. He's not the most
eloquent.
That was the rap against him before this broke, is that, you know, what does he stand for?
My advice to him is the message should be very simple. If you want somebody who votes with President Biden, then vote for Raphael Warnock. If you want somebody that's going to vote like a Republican, vote for me. And he doesn't need to go much farther than that. Now, what I will say is, though, is the real challenge, as it is in every election since the 1996 soccer mom election with Bill Clinton, is that you've got to win those suburban women. And suburban women might split their vote. That's a big thing they're talking about. Will they split the vote between Brian Kemp and Raphael Warnock? Brian Kemp's doing very well, the governor of Georgia. He is hit, you know, the Stacey Abrams campaign is kind of imploding right now. She's having to circle back and get in front of groups that she should have had secured months ago. And Governor Kemp is out doing big events with groups that don't traditionally vote Republican. And so you see the difference in how they're campaigning just by who they're campaigning to. So the governor's race is strong. It looks more and more like the senator's race is going to end up in a runoff, which is not the way it looked up until a few weeks ago. And I think that what's interesting about that, we are a runoff state. There isn't a single poll that has Raphael Warnock over 50%. There was one, I should say there's one poll, but it's an outlier. Usually if all the polls are in the margin of error, except for this one poll that has Herschel Walker substantially behind Raphael Warnock. So we'll see what happens to the polling in the next few weeks. But you're right. Herschel Walker is not the best speaker in the world. He got there on his name ID. It wasn't the Trump endorsement. It was the fact that he is the most popular Georgian because of Georgia football fame. And then you had the combination of that and the University of Georgia winning the national championship this year and a number of things related to that. And it was a perfect storm for Herschel Walker to win that primary with 64-65%.
Now, you mentioned Donald Trump, and you mentioned before Governor Kemp. Kemp has had his problems with Trump and seems to have survived that issue. What's the image of and the role of Donald Trump right now in all of this Georgia political excitement?
Well, there are rumors he's coming the day after the debate. The Warnock and Walker are going to have one debate, and it's rumors he's coming the day after, but we haven't had that confirmed. But my sense is, and I had a caller today that said, you know what, I love Donald Trump, but I'm voting for Brian Kemp because he's done a good job. And people are able to separate out their loyalty to Donald Trump from the fact that we are living in a state that is not only balancing its budget, but is giving back money to the taxpayers and has the lowest gas prices in the country because of how they've managed the transportation fund that is managed by gas taxes. So people are happy right now with the job that Brian Kemp has done. And Trump has been very quiet about Kemp. He's not bashing him anymore. And to Governor Kemp's credit, even when he was getting criticized every day by Donald Trump, he never fought back. He never went back against Trump. He pivoted always to what he had done in the state of Georgia, and that has worked for him.
And what about your friendly governor to the south, Ron DeSantis? What's the view of him at this point? Because obviously what he does as a neighboring governor and a Republican is very interesting, and his relationship with Trump is something that's in the spotlight.
Yeah, it really is, because I think that more and more Governor DeSantis looks in the mirror and not only sees a second-term Florida governor, but sees a president. Now, Ron DeSantis is 44 years old, so he's got plenty of time to run for president. But you got to strike when the iron's hot. That's why we've never said President Howard Baker, right? So you've got to get through there. And I think more and more it's likely that Donald Trump does not run for another term, and you're going to see Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, those kind of younger Republicans running.
How interesting you say strike when the iron's hot. If you recall back in the year that Obama won, when he was looking at running in the primary against Hillary, people said, wait, you're a young man. She's going to get it anyway. Be a good party, you know, person. But he ran and he won. You're absolutely right. When the iron's hot, you got to strike.
Yeah. And he, even though he had only been a senator for 150 days,
right.
I mean, that when he announced, and I think that that's one thing that Ron DeSantis will have to deal with, you know, that he is going to be reelected, I think, in November. I think he's handling the hurricane situation very well. Even even Joe Biden said he was doing a good job when he was there yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, the two of them have become allies.
Bipartisan moment.
The two of them have become allies in terms of the hurricane.
Yes.
Well, that's refreshing.
Yes, they have.
That's radio talk show host and former congressional candidate Martha Zoller of the big signaled station covering most of North Georgia, WDUN Gainesville. Coming up next, a conversation with Jack Heath in another political hotspot, New Hampshire. You're plugged in to the Michael Harrison Wrap. Do you sometimes get the feeling that our society is being overrun by idiots? Do all the stupid, dumb things people say and do make you crazy, 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 crazy? If so, the new song and video by Gun Hill Road is for you.
Idiots walk among us.
They're lazy, lazy, lazy.
Idiots talk among us.
Their speech is often hazy.
Idiots talk among us.
Never ceases to amaze me.
Idiots talk among us.
Tries me crazy, crazy, crazy.
Crazy, 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 crazy.
It's called Idiots. Check out the video. It's free. Idiotsvideo.com. That's idiotsvideo.com. That's idiotsvideo.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the radio shows upon which I appear as a regular guest every week or so is the Jack Heath Show Good Morning New Hampshire, heard statewide on our affiliate network, The Pulse of NH. This week, we both sounded off on negative political campaigning.
Michael, instead of me taking the game to you, take it to us. You're close enough to the weekend. What do you have coming up?
I'll tell you something. It's been a crazy week. Thank you for the lovely introduction. There's a lot of the same things are going on in terms of the broad categories, but there's changes within them. A lot happening with the Russia-Ukraine war, that whole Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, was it? Who knows? The economy is a nonstop conversation. The market has been a roller coaster ride. We're talking about the midterms as they're coming at us like a freight train. Donald Trump's legal woes, I mean, you have to have a law degree to stay up with it. The aftermath of Hurricane Ian has a tremendous amount of things. Immigration, crime, COVID, race relations, abortion, LGBTQ rights.
So nothing going on.
Celebrities in the news.
Yeah, nothing going on, Michael. Yeah, and Tom and Giselle and you name it.
Right, right. It's amazing how the passing parade just keeps coming up with new marching bands.
Yeah.
So how are things in New Hampshire?
Well, it's interesting. I want to bring this one to you, to your question, how are things here? I just had one of our regular analysts and contributors, a buddy of mine, former WMUR political TV director, Josh McKelvin, good political analyst. One of our folks backs up for me. And, you know, we were talking about these ads, and you're not here, so you asked a good question. So we just came out of the primaries a few weeks ago, and we just had some polling done the last day or two. And it's interesting what it shows. Maggie Hassan in that U.S. Senate race, the Democrat incumbent, former two-term governor, probably $20, $30 million has been spent already. The person who won the Republican primary, Don Bolduc, basically was broke coming out of the primary. He didn't do any TV advertising. He did grassroots stuff, and he won against all odds. And now he's the nominee. It should not even be a race, right? Guess what? It is. And you know what it is? Independents haven't started looking at it. And all of a sudden, Hassan is under 50. The Democrats are under 50. And these Republicans have a chance when they probably shouldn't. But one of the things Josh and I ran by, I want to run this by you. You just talked about in the environment and your show this week and all the crazy stuff, the parade going by. The negativity and the divisiveness is getting unhealthy. People are so turned off by it. And none of these candidates with the money are doing the positive ad, like inspirational, like everything's negative. They're saying that their Republican opponent wants to do a federal abortion ban, even though they never said it. That's the ad. And they're extremist and they're anti and they're awful and negative, negative, negative. Not one of these candidates is coming out saying, hi, I'm asking for your vote in November because I believe we can do better. I believe we can be a great nation. I know we have problems, but people, this is a great state. People want to be here. We can do better if we just came together. And that's why I'm running. And, you know, there's no inspirational visionary ad. Everything's negative. And I know negative ad, no one likes them. People say they work. But I'm wondering in this environment, how did someone with no money win that Senate primary by just going around shaking hands?
Well, I'll tell you, because it's, you know, it's a ray of light. And I'm not taking a side in that particular race because I'm not educated.
Nor am I.
But I will say that I'm always delighted when I hear about a candidate who does not spend a lot of money and does not engage in negative campaigning, winning a primary or winning an election, because it shows that there's hope in the American way, at least from an ideal standpoint. Unfortunately, Jack, the reason that this negativity continues, though, in terms of ad campaigns and the slinging of the mud at the other candidate, is because the science of politics, the consultants, the people that make a living out of advising how to run a campaign, almost are unanimous on the idea that this is the only way it works. That you may occasionally have a breakout candidate who does it the other way, but the odds of it are slim, and that if you don't engage in negative campaigning, even if the public says, "Oh, we're sick of it," they'll still go, "Oh, so and so is going to bring back is going to have federal abortion laws, or they're going to tax us." When in fact, they don't understand the proposal.
I agree. I see, and I agree. Before I let you go, but I'm going to share one thing that a few people who are not inherently political. You mentioned Hurricane Ian. And on that Wednesday or Thursday, I talked to more than one person who said they were fixated watching the Weather Channel in the afternoon because that's all you could do to watch the storm pounding loved ones and friends of theirs in Naples, Fort Myers, and all that. And they said, Jack, you talk about this more than me, but these ads that came on every 5 minutes, I just wanted to see about the hurricane. It was so negative, so abrasive, and so nasty that I'm going to vote for the other guy just because I thought they I just got so sick of seeing him. So at some point, is it too much and does it backfire? I guess the jury's out. We don't know until November.
The question's rhetorical, and it's a good question. We can only hope so, because it's tearing the country apart. Yeah. And because it turns your opponent into a demon, somebody that otherwise you'd be very polite to, you'd get along with, you could be friends, neighbors, but now we're running against each other. You are the worst human being that ever lived, and we're going to tell everybody about it.
Yeah, and both sides are responsible. All right, Michael Harrison, the radio wrap this weekend at 2. Thank you, Michael.
That's an excerpt from my appearance this week on the Jack Heath Good Morning New Hampshire show on our affiliate network, The Pulse of NH. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison wrap. Well, Hurricane Ian was a hell of a storm, wreaking pain, destruction, and death across a large swath of Florida. My favorite libertarian, Dr. Murray Sabrin, prolific author and emeritus professor of finance at Ramapo College in New Jersey, lives in Fort Myers, one of the city's hardest hit by Ian, and he wrote a very controversial column about it in Substack. Well, Dr. Sabrin, I have to tell you, you're one of the only people I know who actually lives in Fort Myers. So while the hurricane was happening and we see all these disastrous pictures on CNN and on the news of cars floating down the street, knowing that your electricity was out, I have to say I was worried. I'm glad you're okay. But real quickly, before we get into some of your political theories on the subject, what was it like actually being there during that storm?
We were very fortunate, Michael, because we were very far away from the coast, which was pummeled by this, especially Sanibel Island, where my sister-in-law lives. Unfortunately, she left with her three puppies on Tuesday, right before the storm hit. So she evacuated to a long-term friend's house in Fort Myers near us. And where we were, there were trees down, nothing major, but we were in a very solid four-story building. The windows held up, the roof held up, and so we were one of the blessed people in Fort Myers that the damage to the area was minimal, and we just hunkered down. We lost power for 36 hours. The water came out a week after it went off. So we have to count our blessings every single day that nothing like what happened in Sanibel and Fort Myers Beach affected us.
Were there any leaks in the building at all?
Not that I heard of. I mean, there's some restoration people, so some people may have had some water. In fact, my next-door neighbor said that they had a little bit of water coming in from from the, I guess, the doors to the patio, because they face east, and that's where the wind was ferocious. And we face west and north, so the wind didn't really affect us as much as it did the residents whose windows are south and east.
Were there a lot of people running to the stores, you know, with panic buying? You know, people tend to buy 5 years worth of water. You know, it's like in the Northeast, there's going to be a snowstorm. People buy snow shovels and you know, like they're going to be, you know, snowed in for a month, which doesn't happen anymore. Was there that atmosphere?
No, there was some people buying a lot of toilet paper and water at Costco, where we buy in bulk the water supply that we need at that time. It's over for a week, because when there's a storm of this magnitude hits, you could be out of power for a week or more. So we stocked up with water to make sure that if we needed, we filled up the bathtub. That's the other thing they tell you to do. Fill up your bathtub in case you do lose water, you still have water to flush. So we had enough water to drink. We had water to take care of other needs, and we really rode out the storm as best we possibly could. We stocked up on the food that we needed for the a week or more. And so, like I said, as the old expression goes, knock on wood, we came through this as best as we possibly could.
Beautiful. Now let's turn to Murray Sabrin, the controversial, you know, stirrer, the stirrer upper. And you wrote a column on Substack, where you are a columnist, and it followed the hurricane, and you said some pretty controversial things that I guess reflect your libertarian philosophy about storms and federal aid and insurance. Give us the basic picture.
I think what we saw in this hurricane, given that it's a Category 4, that government provides incentives for people to live in high-risk areas, namely the beach, like Fort Myers Beach and Sanibel Island, which is really right in the Gulf. And so that's called moral hazard. Economists have been writing about this concept for decades. In other words, government creates incentives where people do high-risk activities, and then government bails them out. So in the absence of government subsidies and these incentives, people would not be building at the beach. They're building on higher elevations, and you wouldn't have the total devastation that we saw in Fort Myers Beach, where 85% of the structures are destroyed, and Sanibel Island, where the causeway was washed out, so you can't get to Sanibel Island except by boat. So this is another example why government intervention in the economy leads to these disastrous results.
So basically, you're not suggesting that people play it safe as a rule, because there are people who say, hey, you know, I want to live my life. I want, you know, no risk, no gain. And there's something to be said for that philosophy. You're basically talking about the government's role in encouraging people not to play it that safe because they think the government will bail them out, as opposed to just, you know, be safe. Don't go where there may be a flood. Because if you look around the country, I mean, there's the tornado alley.
Sure.
You have terrible snowstorms. You even say on higher ground, I mean, there are mudslides. There are.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you answer that?
Well, that's why private insurance exists. The insurance companies determine what the underwriting should be for people who live in high-risk areas, whether it's an earthquake area, a tornado area, a snowstorm area, a flood area, and they adjust their premiums to reflect the risk that they are undertaking to protect people from these natural disasters. But if government intervenes and says, if someone lives in these areas and a disaster hit, we're going to bail people out, then, of course, people are going to be building in areas that they otherwise would probably not be, because the insurance premiums may be so high. So again, moral hazard is a concept that we have to come to grips with, because it's costing the federal government, which means the taxpayers, billions and billions of dollars every year, which the federal government doesn't have, because the national debt keeps on rising. It's now $31 trillion, and we're running, a $1 trillion deficit. So the financial repercussions of government under subsidizing high-risk building is really enormous.
Now, what is that term that you used? You're very familiar with it, but I'm not sure everybody is. I'm not that familiar with it myself. Moral hazard, is that what you said?
Moral hazard. The way I explained it to my students when I taught finance is that if I told my students, go to Atlantic City, since I taught in New Jersey for 35 years, and whatever you win in the gambling casino, I will underwrite your losses, but all the gains you will keep. So what's your incentive to gamble at the casino and not do anything productive? So that's moral hazard. So incentives are created where people do things that they otherwise would not do, absent all these incentives.
That's Dr. Murray Sabrin, Emeritus Professor of Finance at Ramapo College in New Jersey, checking in from his home in storm-stricken Fort Myers, Florida. You can read his columns at murraysabrin.substack.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. We're joined now by the man behind the proverbial radio studio glass, our producer and associate publisher of Talkers, law professor Matthew B. Harrison. Well, Matthew, the big buzz happened, I think, Thursday, was when President Biden said that he's pardoning all the cannabis convicts. And I'm not quite sure exactly what that all means. So bring us up to speed.
Well, those who have been convicted of simple possession of marijuana under federal law between 1992 and last year, 2021, which is about 6,500 people, they are being pardoned from that conviction. In addition to thousands of other people who are charged under the criminal code for the District of Columbia, as that also falls within this presidential pardon.
Wow.
The officials are even saying that it's already been carried out, that there are no individuals currently in federal prison for simple possession. And Biden is encouraging governors to do the same thing with state convictions, because the states have not reached a full agreement as to what should be legal, what is medicinal, what is recreational. Each state varies, and they're hoping to sort of close this difference.
It's a race relations issue as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is really hard to overcome a federal conviction of any sort, and that can make getting a job or getting a housing really difficult. And unfortunately, that falls on the shoulders of minorities much more than just the percentage of people who smoke marijuana.
That's our show's producer. He's associate publisher of Talkers and a law professor, and he looks a lot more like me than I do, Matthew B. Harrison. Coming up next, two more excerpts from my current podcast interviews with Glenn Beck and Tavis Smiley. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
This report is brought to you by Genesis 2 Project, G2P. Recently, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the ODNI, released a preliminary report on possible threats posed by UFOs, now known as Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, UAP, and the progress the Department of Defense UAP Task Force has made in understanding any threats. Dr. J.C. Van Valkenburg is a former Los Alamos National Lab biophysicist who has been working with G2P to bring scientifically sound UAP data to the public.
G2P has released the first scientifically authenticated documentation of UAPs, including images captured with infrared technology. Primo Forensics performed the digital forensic analysis.
In tandem with the ODNI report, these data support the development of relevant processes, policies, technologies, and training for the U.S. military and government personnel upon encountering UAP. Visit Genesis2Project.com.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. Last week, we played excerpts from my two most recent podcasts with multimedia personalities Glenn Beck, a conservative, and Tavis Smiley, a liberal. We got great reaction, so we're dipping into that bag of goodies for this segment of the hour with two more excerpts while the topics are still hot. Let's start out with Glenn Beck, star of talk radio and TV, media entrepreneur, prolific author, and showman extraordinaire. How do you feel differently today than you did, say, 2 years ago?
Strangely, I'm more optimistic, but things are getting much worse, and I think it's going to get much, much worse before it gets better. you know, we haven't hit bottom yet, but people are starting to wake up in the country, and they're starting to wake up all over the world. I'm a little concerned about what it means to be on the right side in Europe, because that has typically meant fascism. But I'm not convinced that at this point that's where they're going. I think people are just waking up that it is the people versus the elites. I am more optimistic because I think people are realizing all over the world, wow, wait a minute, this is not just my country, and it's not just, you know, a Democrat Republican thing. This is happening all over the world, and this is we're struggling with a viewpoint from the elites that they can control and manage everything, and we'll live the life they want us to live. And I just don't think Americans are going to be there for that.
As a very bright man, and following your career for so many decades as I have, I know you before you were syndicated, and you were a bright disc jockey at one time. So, I mean, you've always been ahead of the curve. Do you ever stop and think anthropologically or in terms of the DNA of the human condition that maybe it's more about the way we're wired and leadership? Because you said something very interesting, that sometimes it's a little it makes you a little nervous with the right because of its connection to fascism.
Of Europe.
Does it ever just make you nervous that when the elite overthrow, when the regular people overthrow the elite, that there'll be a new elite running things?
Yeah. That's
what we're
saying. Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, this is why our founders wanted the power to be with the people, because, you know, power in and success and fame. I've said success and fame are battery acid to the soul, but so is power. And, you know, you can get the best people in power, and then all of a sudden they start believing they're the elites. I'm very concerned. You know, life and society is a pendulum. And it swings from one extreme to the next. And we're best when we're in the middle. And right now we are in a we society, a we cycle. And that becomes very dangerous because it becomes about the collective. And if the pendulum is stopped here, we're in real danger. But the pendulum is starting to swing back, and I think people can feel it. But it'll take 20 years for us to get back to the middle, and then another 20 years to get to the me generation again. This is a very dangerous place, and I've said it for years. It depends on who's in power when the event happens that will force somebody, or they'll think they're forced, to grab the pendulum and stop it where it is.
I don't think anybody can stop it, but it's in the attempt to stop it that we wind up getting herky-jerky, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's that's how you end up with authoritarians.
Yeah. Well, do you see danger here in America in terms of the right and authoritarianism?
Not as much on the right as the left, but I do think all sides have... It scares me, you know, I learned this from Martin Luther King. It scares me when somebody says, you know, they just want to beat them. They just want to win. We can't have that mentality in America. We have to come back together. Now, that doesn't mean we come together with the people who are literally trying to overthrow our nation. I don't want to come together with, you know, the people who really were serious about, you know, killing Mike Pence or whatever on January 6th. There's no place for them at the table. And there's no place at the table for those who hate America, want to destroy it, and have actively engaged in that. But the 80, 90% of us that think we're enemies of each other, we're really not. We just have to rediscover the things that we have in common that always kept us together. And that is human rights, the rights given to us by God, the things that we used to find self-evident. Right now, they're in question, and mainly being questioned because the elites are saying they don't exist, or they don't exist the way we've always understood them. But they do, and that's the truth, and we'll eventually come back to that. But if you are looking for, I'm going to win, we got to beat them, that is going to lead to half the country being a loser. Mm-hmm. We're experiencing that right now with the Biden administration, and it could easily go the other direction. But they're saying this whole half of the country is an enemy and a danger to the country. Well, when you play that out, where does that end? Where does that end?
No, no,
that ends with rounding people up.
Yeah.
Either side could do it.
It ends with seeking victory at the expense of truth, which is what's
correct.
Going on. It happens
correct.
In the media. Do you think the media is feeding this with targeting audiences, giving them the red meat they want, as opposed to taking the chance to tell them something they may not want to hear?
Yes.
That's what I see.
And I think we all wrestle with that to some degree or another. I mean, the willingness to lose your following is very low. You know, if we self-preserve, it's what we do. Once we start, though, saying, I have to preserve my voice because who else will do it, so I'll compromise, that's when you become a problem.
Is Donald Trump a problem for the Republicans and for conservatives at this point? Because it seems to me, trying to be an objective observer and being as fair as I can, you know, in my role as publisher of Talkers and, you know, just keeping an even keel and believing in the First Amendment, it appears to me that there's been this daily dance of affirmation, this problem, if you will, that conservative talk show hosts and conservative politicians and Republicans have with Donald Trump. It's an abstract concept, but I know you know what I'm talking about. What's mm-hmm. What's your take on that from your observations and from your own experience?
So, you know, I was very against Donald Trump until I saw what he did when he was in office that proved me wrong. I never thought he would do the things that he did. And I was very concerned about the rhetoric and everything else. And I still am. I don't like the rhetoric. You know, he'd have 4 years. I don't know what a Donald Trump does in 4 years, except probably go after the deep state with a real passion. And so that, in some ways, that makes him good. And also, warning, it could be dangerous, because if it's personal, then we don't get justice. That, you know, makes me nervous. I am torn on Donald Trump. And as I think a lot of people are, if he's the candidate, I'm voting for Donald Trump. And I think most conservatives feel that way, that we cannot allow another term with a Democrat. The way we're going, I don't know how we survive to 2024. So I would vote for Donald Trump. However, I would much rather have somebody that doesn't have the baggage. This is an interesting balance point. Somebody that doesn't have the baggage, doesn't have the hatred of Donald Trump, but has the passion and the understanding when he hits the ground. Donald Trump learned a lot, and he will not hit the ground running the way he did before. Believe me, he knows what the problems are, and he's one of the only people, I think, we know for sure he is not afraid to take it on.
That's another excerpt from my deep dive conversation of last week with noted media star Glenn Beck. You can hear the entire conversation that I conducted with Glenn Beck on my podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, at mhinterview.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. And now for the second part of our podcast in review that we began last week. Another excerpt from my interview with multimedia commentator, prolific author, owner of radio station KBLA Talk 1580 in Los Angeles, and spokesman for the liberal African-American perspective, Tavis Smiley. Now, within the black community, one of the things that we deal with politically, and I don't want to say within the black community, black is too big to be a community, within the black population, all right? Right. Because, you know, it's a whole nation of people of color and among them African-Americans. When you say progressive, do you face any blowback from within the black population that, hey, man, you're talking about me. You can't say what I am. I'm black, but you can't make assumption. I mean, look at the recent gubernatorial bid by an African-American
Larry Elder.
You know, how do you deal with the diversity and the opinionated diversity within the black population?
It's a very good question. I mentioned earlier in this conversation, Michael, that my career started on KABC Talk Radio, which was at one point the number one station in the city, not just talk. It was the number one station, and I was a part of the number one show on that number one station, Ken and Barkley. That's why I started my career. So I know what it's like to be on a number one station and on a station that caters to a largely white audience. I was at that station when we brought Larry Elder in. The great talk show host, Dennis Prager, discovered Larry Elder when he was on a station in Ohio. Larry is actually from L.A. He's from Watts. I left here to go to school, went to Michigan Law, settled in Ohio. Dennis Prager discovered him and convinced the folk at KABC that Larry would do well and brought him back home to L.A., and Larry Elder becomes a major figure on KABC, and the rest, as they say, is history. So when Larry ran for governor against Gavin Newsom in this recall election in California that the whole nation was watching, I invited Larry on the station and invited him on my show. And for an hour, we went at it, but we've known each other for years, and I gave Larry the space on the station as a black conservative to have his say. I've had any number of black conservatives. Michael Steele, the former chair of the Republican National Committee, has been a guest on this station, as have others. So because we are unapologetically progressive, that is, we want people to know who have more progressive views that there's a place for them. That does not mean that we don't invite voices on that may differ from ours. I say all the time to my team here that at our best, we are a station that challenges people to re-examine the assumptions they hold and helps them to expand their inventory of ideas. You can't do that by only talking to people who agree with you. So this station is a welcome space even for those who disagree with us. If you listen to our callers, they will oftentimes call and take us to task for points of views that we espouse that they may not agree with. And so it's a welcome space. And I think people know that, again, with Tavis Smiley helming it, they know that I've never run away from conversations that perhaps can enlighten me and allow me to see the world through a different prism. So we put the welcome mat out for everybody, number one. Number two, to your question about whether or not we get pushback from black people, not so much. Where we do get pushback on that progressive ideology, that progressive terminology, is in the advertising space. I can't tell you, Michael, the number of meetings I've been in where my brand management team, my sales team, is on the verge of closing a deal, but somebody in the hierarchy, typically someone white in the hierarchy, wants to know what do we mean when we say unapologetically progressive.
That's another excerpt from my recent podcast interview with well-known media commentator, author, spokesman representing the liberal point of view held by many African Americans, and the owner of radio station KBLA Talk 1580 in Los Angeles, Tavis Smiley. You can hear the entire conversation at mhinterview.com. And that about does it for this latest installment of the Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation, looking back at the week of Monday, October 3rd through Friday, October 7th, 2022. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And don't forget about my song Idiots with Gun Hill Road.
Crazy, 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 crazy.
At idiotsvideo.com, The Michael Harrison Wrap. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications, presented in association with Talk Media Network and Talkers Magazine. Copyright 2022, all rights reserved.